Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with Episode 77 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling the Dryland Doctor, Bill Schillinger. Wheat farmers who live in the wetter areas of the state may not be familiar with the Washington State University agronomist, but in the 8 to 12-inch rainfall region, his is a well-known name. Schillinger is research station professor and principal scientist at the Lind Dryland Research Station, located on 320 acres outside of Lind, Washington, about 17 miles south of Ritzville. It is located in an area that averages only 9.6 inches of moisture per year, giving it the distinction of being the driest rain-fed experiment station in the nation. By the way, the Lind Field Day occurs this coming Thursday, June 14th, 2018. It's educational, fun, and free. You should attend. The Lind Station was created 103 years ago at the behest of farmers in the region who hadn't yet gone out of business. During its history, there has always been at least one or more WSU scientists based there. Lind is located in an area of summer fallow farming. For those who listen to the podcast and may not understand the term, a quick primer. Summer fallow refers to the practice of only one crop on a particular piece of ground every other year. The off or fallow year is intended to store moisture for the subsequent crop. Wheat farmers refer to it as a summer fallow rotation. When I became an agricultural reporter for the Capital Press in 1986, most farmers in the summer fallow area of the state were using what was called a dust mulch practice as part of their summer fallow operation. It was hard for me to wrap my head around the idea of making a mulch out of dust. If you're like me, you think of a mulch as being made out of organic material like leaves, bark, or compost, used to enrich the soil or keep weeds down. In order to make the dust mulch, farmers had to till the land multiple times. As I recall, it wasn't out of the ordinary for a farmer to go over his field seven or more times. These repeated operations buried residue and pulverized the soil. Perhaps it's called a dust mulch because one of the traditional uses of mulches is to insulate the ground. In the case of the dust mulch, it helps prevent moisture from escaping through evapotranspiration, the process through which moisture in the land is transferred to the atmosphere. In July and August in eastern Washington, there's a whole lot of evapotranspiration going on. I remember the first time I stepped into a field with a dust mulch that had been set. My shoe was swallowed, covered up by the soil the consistency of talcum powder. I was taken aback that this soil could support waving fields of wheat in short order. Much of the soil in the summer fallow region is made up of loess soils, spelled L-O-E-S-S. Almost all of them have one thing in common, a high percentage of PM10 particulates, a term which refers to the size of the soil particle. PM10 is very small and can be breathed in and lodge in the lungs. Over the 30-plus years I've lived in Spokane, multiple windstorms have occurred, blowing farmers' soil into the city and onward. Ditto the Tri-Cities. Much of Schillinger's research has been dedicated toward reducing these dust events by helping farmers find alternatives to dust mulch. And practices have changed, as you'll hear in our conversation ahead. The undercutter, a blade which slices the soil beneath the surface, is one method and leaves a lot of residue, although it can be finicky. Some brave souls are also transitioning into summer fallow direct seed, either as one-pass purists or as part of a couple of operations. Over the years, Schillinger introduced me to the concept of the coleoptile and the importance of a winter wheat variety having a strong one to push up through 4 to 6 inches of soil cover. For the record, the coleoptile, spelled C-O-L-E-O-P-T-I-L-E, is the sheath that surrounds the first leaf of the wheat seedling as it pushes upward through the soil. I interviewed Schillinger in his WSU office in a complex in Cheney. He also has an office at Lind. I always come to my interviews with a set of questions that gives me a general idea of how long the interview will last. At Schillinger's interview, however, next thing I know, we've been talking for an hour and 40 minutes, the equivalent of almost five podcasts. No, I'm not going to give you a five-parter, but this is part one of two parts. Before I get to the agronomy section of the podcast, I wanted people to get to know Schillinger before he started work at the Linn Station, January 1, 1993. I asked him to describe his background.
I grew up on a wheat farm 7 miles south of Odessa, Washington.
Uh-huh. Did you ever want to be a farmer?
Well, I was the only son, and so I certainly got lots of farming work. We were not big farmers. My dad owned just 536 acres, and we rented another, 1,300 or so. And so, you know, let's call it, 850, 900 acres per year, wheat fallow. Back then, that was considered a medium-sized acreage. Now it'd be nothing. My dad really wanted me to be a farmer, and at age 18, he said, well, if you're going to farm, we need to get more land. I've got an option to buy some ground. It was a section of ground, a farmer. That'd be, you know, you need to expand if you're going to do it. And I said, Dad, I'm 18. I'm not going to make that kind of commitment when I'm 18. So basically the answer is, you know, I'm not going to commit to that.
Interesting. That is a large commitment at 18.
Yeah.
And so you went off to school. Where'd you go to school?
I went to school at Eastern Washington University, and they don't even have agriculture classes at Eastern. So I studied a little bit of biology and some communications of all things and got a sort of a general degree. And that's what I did in my undergraduate years. And that was right during the later stages of Vietnam. So I was very interested in staying in college and less interested in academics at that stage of my life.
I usually don't use ages in these podcasts, but I'm just curious. So are you just a couple of years older than me? Are you 66?
I am 66.
There was a big difference between being 18 when you were and 18 when I was.
Yes. I graduated in the class of 1970, Odessa High School. And Vietnam was very much going on at the time.
We have something in common. We're both Peace Corps volunteers. When were you a Peace Corps volunteer, and where did you go?
I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I went to Nepal, which is literally halfway around the world. And I was served from 1975 through the end of 1977. I worked with a certified seed program for producing certified wheat and rice seed in the eastern region of Nepal, and I thought it was an important job, certainly an important time in my life. Literally hard living, as you know, Scott. It was tough living, but we're young and resilient, and we did it.
Yes, we did. And just for the record, I was in Togo, West Africa from 1978 to 1980.
Well, I spent 7 years of my life in Nepal, because after my Peace Corps service, Peace Corps hired me to be the director of their agriculture programs. And so me, well, okay. And so I did that for 2 years in a salaried position. And after that, then I decided, well, you know, agricultural development's really interesting and it's important. And why didn't I study agronomy when I had the chance as an undergraduate? So I went back to graduate school at Davis, California, University of California, Davis, and they provisionally accepted me, but they said, well, you really didn't take a heck of a lot of science in your undergraduate, so they loaded me up with a whole bunch of science. I had to take even more math for 2 quarters before I got admitted into the agronomy program. But I did, and so I went through there, and that's when I met my wife, Valerie. And after that, I took a position with the Agency for International Development and was assigned to the Africa Division as an agricultural officer.
And where did you go?
To Cameroon.
Oh.
And so that was interesting, but it really wasn't what I wanted to do. What I saw was the people that we hired to implement our projects were having all the fun, and these were the scientist types. And so about that time, I was contacted by the Windrock International, which is sort of the offshoot of the Rockefeller Foundation, for to do go back to Nepal for a three-year assignment as a cropping systems agronomist in the hilly regions of central Nepal. A three-year assignment, and my wife said, "Yeah, let's go for it." And the plan was, after that, I'm going to go to graduate school, we'll save up some money, and I'll go get a PhD, and then get a real scientist job. So we did that. So that was my experience in Nepal, 7 years there, and then 3 years in Africa. So,
Wow, how fascinating. And where did you get your PhD?
At Oregon State.
Mm-hmm. And that was in agronomy?
It was in agronomy, wheat agronomy, with Dr. Floyd Bolton was my advisor. And so I finished that up in 92.
And was the job at WSU your first job? Or
it was. It just sort of fell into place. And I think most of your listeners will know, but the Lind Research Station, the WSU Lind Dry Land Research Station, is that's only 20 miles south of where my family farm is located, or was located. We no longer have that land.
I came across a paper in my files you wrote back in 1996. It was about basically dust mulch. And when I was a young reporter, I learned about dust mulch, and I'm just curious, is there dust mulch farming going on now in the area?
Well, it is often referred to as dust mulch farming, or tillage mulch farming. There's sort of a difference the way I look at it. A dust mulch implies that the ground is all dust, no clods, and very little residue. And that certainly has been the case, and you can still see it. And that's an extremely undesirable condition to have. A tillage mulch, on the other hand, could be you still have the dry soil layer, but it will contain clods with ample residue on top, which is much more favorable or desirable for wind erosion control.
Okay, so when we look at farming practices out there, how would you break down practices in the summer fallow area by percentage? I mean, how much is still in that conventional dust mulch? How much is in undercutter or sweep? How much is direct seed, and meaning two or three passes? And how much is no-till? Am I missing anything?
Well, some of that overlaps a little bit. I would say when you say dust mulch, are you referring to farmers who are just doing things the same way they did 50 years ago?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, maybe 10%. And believe it or not, there are still people out there that are not using glyphosate, very few, for burn down in the spring, but very, very few.
So that means they're depending upon their iron to do their herbicide.
That's right. But again, that's pretty much a thing of the past. As far as the conservation till, I think most farmers would say they're doing that. There's different degrees of conservation till. Many times you can go out with a cultivator, and this is very common. You just hook your fertilizer rig up in front of your cultivator, and it's a somewhat aggressive implement, but you are combining two operations in one pass, and in heavy residue years, that works just fine. And they would say that's conservation farming, and I would agree with them in most cases, unless their previous crop wasn't a very good crop and didn't leave much stubble. Conservation tillage is defined by having 30% residue cover after you plant. So that's the important measure as far as the NRCS is concerned. Then you get to the undercutter method, which is a complete underground operation, a slicing with a thin blade and injecting your fertilizer. That's really, that's sort of the Cadillac of conservation tillage. So most people are doing a lot better jobs than their fathers and certainly their grandfathers did. As far as the direct seed, that has taken off considerably. I would maybe put that at 10% right now and growing.
And when we're talking about direct seed, I mean, there's a different definition of direct seed and no-till, at least as I'm using it. And direct seed is, yeah, we're planting with a direct seed implement, but we're doing a couple of tillages, perhaps.
Yes, and you see that, and you've got that. You know, some of these farmers don't want to do any tillage at all, and that they don't. Yeah, and then there's other farmers that'll go out and they'll go out maybe in late June or whatever, and they'll do a skew treading operation, and they'll just say, well, I've created a little 2-inch mulch. That's all I want to do, and that's enough to help retard some water. And okay, that's fine. And then they'll seed into that. Others will do maybe something more aggressive, which is, I guess that's fine too. Others won't do anything at all. They'll just completely rely on herbicides, and they'll direct seed into undisturbed stubble from the previous crop. True, that's what I'd call true direct seeding, and I think that's mostly how it's defined.
Where do we stand with wind erosion? That was something that was very big on your list of issues back in the day. Where are we now?
It's still a big issue. Wind erosion, we've learned a lot about wind erosion. We've had the Columbia Plateau PM10 project for 13 years, a special grant from USDA. Made lots of headway on wind erosion, learned lots of things. Is wind erosion as bad as it used to be? No. Is that directly related to farming practices? Yes. Farmers are doing a better job protecting the soil. However, we still have a way to go. We still have these. We don't have as many dust events, but we still have too many. And in all cases, the exceedances that we receive on these federal air quality monitoring sites are related to blowing dust, and that's coming from ground after potatoes in the basin, exposed ground, or excessively tilled. Mostly it's excessively tilled summer fallow with not enough clods and residue. So we've made headway, the farmers have made headway, it still happens. It's very interesting. Brenton Sherritt, USDA ARS, did long-term work on many farms over many years in Adams County on wheat fallow ground, and he went out and put out air monitoring stations, quite an array of samplers, some of these very high-tech, in summer fallow fields on the windward and leeward side, so he could measure, big fields. And he measured dust coming off of these fields. And I should say, and you know this, but many listeners might not, is that our soils in the Columbia Plateau are somewhat unique in that they contain quite a bit of PM10, which means very small particulates that can stay in. What's really important agronomically is once they're emitted through wind erosion, they can stay airborne for a long time and travel hundreds and even thousands of miles. And so we're not just swapping soils with our neighbors in windstorms. It's going up, and we're losing a lot of that. Well, Brenton went out over a number of years, and he measured this, and then he looked at the amount of carbon in these dust samples. And there's a lot of carbon in those samples. Even on the PM10 size particles, there's carbon adhering to those. And so he just submitted a paper this week, and I'm a co-author in the paper, so I'm pretty familiar with the work. And we think, and I think it's probably correct, that this carbon loss that we've experienced since the onset of farming 140 years ago is in the dry area is mostly due to wind erosion, not the oxidation and that most of us associate loss of carbon with, but he measured substantial quantities in dust, and if we look back at all these historic dust storms we've had, brownouts, complete zero visibility, my goodness, tons and tons of soil coming off in individual windstorms with all that carbon, we think that's where half of our carbon is gone, up into the air.
So I learned a lot about coleoptiles, including how to pronounce coleoptiles through your research. but I haven't heard much about coleoptiles in a while. What's the latest?
Well, there's a couple of recent developments. Kulvinder Gill and a postdoc that we had, Mohita Mohan, we did a lot of work with this at Lind, looking at 640 varieties, their coleoptile length, all sorts of things. And one thing we learned, which was, I think, good information, is that if you get anything over about 95 millimeters in length, it no longer benefits emergence.
Is that because they're too weak by the time they get up there?
That's our speculation, that they're too spindly. And so that's sort of interesting. And so some of these lines have really long coleoptiles, you know, 115, 120 millimeters. But those were not a good emergers. We didn't have any of those that were good emergers. So you look at the king of emergence, which, of course, is the old variety Moro, that had a coleoptal length of, oh, big surprise, 90, 95 millimeters. So we think it might have to do with the thickness of the coleoptile providing strength. Two individuals in Oregon, Larry Lucher at Oregon State and Stuart Wiest at ARS Pendleton, just finished an experiment looking at coleoptile push force. And they devised a rather unique apparatus, a very sensitive apparatus, to measure the strength of a coleoptile, and both a coleoptile from shallow planting and the first leaf from deep planting in pots, until the leaf kinked, or the coleoptile kinked. I think that it does probably have something to do with the thickness and the overall strength and sturdiness of that coleoptile and first leaf. It's the kinking. How much force does it take to kink the leaf? And then the plant's finished, as we know. And then Aaron Carter, the WSU winter wheat breeder, has taken this seriously. We've funded this research through the Otto and Doris Amon Endowment through Steve Jones and now Aaron Carter for 15 plus years, and Aaron's taking this seriously, and he most recently released the hard red winter wheat line Sequoia, which basically was released. It's a good wheat for quality and everything too, but it's, you know, for really good emergence.
Your coleoptile research is based on deep furrow planting. I mean, when the farmer is planting, searching for the moisture, going 6 inches deep and planting his seed into the moisture, and then the seed has to, or the coleoptile has to come up through that 6 inches of soil and, you know, do its thing. Won't these new farming practices that farmers are using, the direct seed, for instance, the no-till, won't that render the whole coleoptile discussion moot because you won't need to plant so deep?
I don't see deep planting going away. If you want to have your optimum planting time for winter wheat, winter pea, or winter triticale, they all want to be planted early, and you will have a yield penalty if you have to plant them later.
So you can't plant into direct seed in September after a rain, for
instance? Oh, very well. That's one of the benefits of direct seed, is that if you do catch those rains, and we seem to be catching more of those in recent years, then you're in really good shape. If you have not tilled your soils, those capillary pores and channels remain open. Those are just pathways for that water to get into the soil. You will wet up and have that moisture line meet much more readily than if you have tilled fallow. It's actually really difficult to happen with tilled fallow. Again, it works both ways. If you till your ground, you are sort of preventing moisture from going up, but you're also preventing it from going down. So that is a true benefit of direct seed. I've had some long-term research for 21 years now with Ron Duray on his farm, 5 miles, let's call it 5 miles west of Ritzville, 11.5-inch precip zone. We've direct seeded many of those plots every year for 21 years. But most interestingly, we took some of those direct seed plots and transitioned those into fallow, no-till fallow plots 8 years ago. And And we were thinking, well, we're going to probably have to seed late most of these years because of inadequate water. All 8 of those years, Scott, we've been able to seed deep into carryover water there.
I once wrote a story based on an interview with an NRCS employee who was pretty high up in the agency. He believed that direct seeding was the future of most of Washington's summer fallow area. Recalling the farmers who protested back in the 1980s that they couldn't meet conservation tillage guidelines when they were implemented, he said, "You put a bar in front of farmers," and he was speaking here of regulation, "and they'll figure out how to jump over it." Long-term research is certainly a valuable element in determining what needs to be done to make that leap, as well as for revealing farming insights and trends. Certainly, if Schillinger's research since his arrival at the Lind Station in January 1993 has taught us anything, it's that change is constant, whether in response to climate, technology, or environmental regulation. In The Dryland Doctor, Bill Schillinger, Part 2, we talk more about direct seeding, cover crop research in dry areas, climate change, the status of the deep furrow drill replacement, and more. Please join me again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.